Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A place where some serious intelligence briefing is in order is Korea. At the moment, thanks in part to some astonishing developments in the past 24 hours in which the South Korean government has made representations of an interest on the part of the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-un, to meet with President Trump, and President Trump has accepted an invitation for a summit sometime between now and May, we're told, to discuss this astonishing development and whether there is likely to be anything good coming of it. Lawrence Peck has a Juris Doctor degree from Loyola Law School. He is also an advisor to the indispensable North Korea Freedom Coalition. He has worked in South Korea. He has extensive networks there and has been monitoring closely, among other things, what the North Koreans have been doing in our own country, unbeknownst to most of us, to conduct influence operations and who knows what all else. To get a sense of what this so-called breakthrough might actually mean on the ground and for us, I'm delighted to welcome back Lawrence Peck. Lawrence, good to have you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Pleasure to be with you again.
So, in sort of the broadest of outlines, remind us what this North Korean regime has been and, as far as we can tell, still is when it comes to its attitude towards the United States and, for that matter, towards South Korea. Does this suggest, given the pattern of, well, decades now, several generations of the Kim dynasty, a certain behavior that might make us a little suspicious about what's afoot at the moment?
Well, yes. In terms of their basic view of us, which really hasn't much changed since we prevented them from dominating the entire Korean Peninsula during the Korean War, has been that we are their sworn enemy, which they just continue to repeat in their media as recently as just hours ago. And they consider us their sworn enemy because we stand in the way of their primary goal, which is, as I alluded to, the communization of the or domination, otherwise, of the entire Korean peninsula. They use their own expressions on a daily basis to express their views towards us. For example, the quaint expression, they cannot live under the same sky with us, the U.S. imperialists. And of course, they've been expressing that hostility and vengeance towards us in various ways down through the decades, up to and including the murder of Americans, the seizure of Americans on the high seas, the counterfeiting of U.S. currency, and in a myriad of other ways.
Let me just make sure I'm clear about something you just said, Lawrence Peck, that a few hours ago, as we're speaking, would be after President Trump has accepted this idea of sitting down with Kim Jong-un. Are you telling me that the North Korean propaganda operations are still pumping out virulently anti-American rhetoric and essentially instructions to their people?
Yeah, well, yes, certainly that hasn't changed too much. I mean, you might say, let's say, over the past couple of hours, it hasn't been quite as vitriolic as it has, let's say, over 2 days ago. But certainly, for example, on the day that they had spoken to the South Koreans and apparently given this message to President Trump, to the South Koreans, when they were meeting in Pyongyang with a high-level South Korean delegation, on that very day, they were printing editorials in the official organ of the ruling Korean Workers' Party, Nodong Shimun, that they indicating that they would never give up their nuclear weapons at that point. And that was, in an authoritative source.
knowing what you do of these guys, would you say that, well, that just could be that they hadn't gotten the word that this is moving so rapidly that they were operating on previous guidance, not current ones? Or is this evidence of bad faith on the part of the North Koreans, do you think?
Well, I think we can look at something a little more concrete than their propaganda in terms of perhaps what their true intentions are, which is the fact that just a couple of days ago, there was a report in the Telegraph, the Daily Telegraph, that they had ramped up plutonium production at their Yongbyon nuclear plant. Plutonium production, of course, for their nuclear weapons program.
So as we're looking at this meeting, Rocket Man Summit, I call it. What is the likely effect going to be, Lawrence Peck, as you see it, with respect to the legitimacy of this regime, not only internationally, but at home as well? And knowing of the work that you all have been doing at the North Korean Freedom Coalition, my friend Suzanne Schulte, among others, has been a champion of the liberation of the people of North Korea from this horrific regime. Is this likely to make that outcome much less likely, do you think?
Well, that's something that I fear, and I believe that other human rights activists who focus on North Korea would fear, which is that whether wittingly or not, this if a summit does occur, it could serve certainly to perhaps legitimize, so to speak, the regime and perhaps even Kim Jong-un himself, and because it's something that we have seen throughout our history. You may remember after the opening of China, you may remember everyone was running out and buying their Mao tunics. And you may recall that when Gorbachev would come here, all of a sudden Gorby was the rage. So that kind of a euphoria about the North Korean regime, which obviously it doesn't merit as one of the world's most brutal totalitarian dictatorships, might occur. That's certainly a fear.
Let me ask you, Lawrence Peck, finally, quite apart from what this might mean in terms of abandoning those in North Korea yearning for freedom, some might argue, well, that's a small price to pay for actually achieving the denuclearization of the North Korean state and therefore the peninsula, and ending the threat that it has been assiduously developing against this country as well. Just again, if you would put a fine point on it, is it likely, in your estimation, based on what you've seen to date, the history of the Kim dynasty, as well as what you are seeing reported in the North Korean state media, that we will in fact see an end to the kinds of programs in which the regime has invested massively and at the great expense to their people?
Well, first, let me say that even if they were by some chance, and I don't believe that they would be eventually willing to give up entirely their nuclear program, but let's just assume for the sake of argument that they were, of course, that doesn't end in itself. That would end, obviously, the nuclear threat, but there are a whole range of other threats which the North opposes through the proliferation of other kinds of WMDs, whether they be the chemical weapons, which, as you know from the recent stories they've been providing to the Syrians, or whether it be their numerous illicit criminal activities, whether it be hacking into banks around the world or counterfeiting U.S. currency or being an international source of the drug trade. But that's just for the purpose of argument. I actually don't believe, just looking at their whole reason for being and their whole goal in developing their nuclear weapons program in the first place, it seems hard to believe that they would give it up, even if they were to receive a nice batch of goodies and concessions of the type which they can be expected to ask for. They refer to the nuclear program as their treasured sword, for good reason, being that that's something which essentially guarantees the survival of their regime.
Much food for thought here. Lawrence Peck, we will be talking with you, I know, a lot in the weeks ahead running up to this summit. And I appreciate your insights and especially your reporting on what they're saying to their own people, which may be evidence of a double game that President of the United States would be well advised to be attending to. Next up, Ken Timmerman joins us. We'll talk with him about Iran and the threat it poses to all of us right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. I'm pleased to have with us for the first time a man I've only just met now by phone. He is Ronnie Krause, a business owner and electrical engineer by training who has long done business with American companies in his native South Africa. He is currently inside the United States because of what is happening to folks like him in South Africa, a subject that has not gotten very much attention, as best I can tell, in this country, but urgently needs it, it seems to me. I'm delighted to welcome Ronnie Krause, the owner and CEO of Marston Moore Technologies, the South African company. Ronnie, thank you so much for joining us and for taking a few minutes to talk with us about what's happening in your country.
Thank you, Frank. Absolute pleasure.
Well, to give an audience that hasn't perhaps heard much about this a quick lay of the land, what is going on in South Africa at the moment as it relates to folks like yourself who are Caucasians?
Well, the from a professional point of view and from a working perspective, it's become increasingly difficult, now impossible, with the implementation over a long period of time, and I'm talking approximately, more than 10 years now, where the first part of the difficulty experienced was with the implementation of what they call BEE, which to those that do not know is Black Economic Empowerment. And what they have now introduced is what they call broad-based Black Economic Empowerment. And this basically means, in short, that white people have been excluded from the job market. You have companies, and it's well documented, that people like Woolworths have stated that they will not employ white people as engine. They state they will not employ white people. So white people have an extremely big hill to climb when it comes to job opportunities, and well-educated people are sitting without work.
Ronnie Krause is with us. We're talking about what has befallen his country, South Africa. And Ronnie, as I'm listening to you tell this saga, it's calling to mind a television program that I once hosted called The World This Week. And we did a segment about the new state of South Africa as Nelson Mandela was coming to power. And I must say, I had very profound misgivings that a party like his, the African National Congress, was going to actually behave properly in a democratic and embracing fashion. It's taken longer to get to this point, I guess, but I'm not entirely surprised that it has. Talk, if you would, about beyond not being able to get employment, I'm told that white farmers and I suspect other business owners are facing confiscation of their property, their assets. Is that also happening? And is there a potential for violence as well?
Well, if I can just start by your comment when Mr. Nelson Mandela came out of jail and why it's taken so long. Nelson Mandela was a phenomenal man. You know, everybody has a different point of view, But what Mr. Mandela commanded was respect of his people, and his people listened to him and give the man his due. He put aside his differences and he calmed the people, and he built and started building this Rainbow Nation. Unfortunately, after his death, and new people coming in, you know what the state of the corruption is, and the people do not, there's such factionalism at the point. And then you have people like Julius Malema openly in stadiums saying, shoot the farmer. And one thing, you've probably heard the slogan, shoot the Boer, shoot the farmer. And in the Afrikaans language, when they say shoot the Boer, now, when somebody is a farmer, he says, I'm a boer, which means he's a farmer. But in fact, what the people see is a white man. So when they say shoot the farmer, they mean shoot the white man. Now, the atrocities that is happening on the farms, there are some statistics out that the average citizen in South Africa is murdered 36 to 100,000 in a year. Now, a month. South African farmers are 193 per 100,000 people are being murdered. And it's the highest stake in the world. So the atrocities, if I want to tell you, if you can imagine a child being boiled in a bath of boiling hot water, where the sister's raped and the mother's throat is slit, and the parents are being gagged and bound and had to watch this, and then he's assassinated. I don't know.
This is a documented example of atrocities being perpetrated against farmers in South Africa, white farmers?
And the problem is that the police are not investigating these. They're turning a blind eye.
There is, I'm told, in addition to the hostility towards the whites that is now being fanned, evidently, by the political parties there, and I gather it's not just the ANC, it's others as well, there is a tribal rift as well that perhaps what you were referring to with factionalism, but to talk a little bit about that and what this is likely to portend. Some have compared what's happening now, Ronnie Krauss, to Zimbabwe and what it did to whites and farmers in particular. Is this likely to be worse, in fact, as a result of this factionalism?
It's going to be far worse purely because of the amount of people. And Zimbabwe was fortunate because the people could come across the border into a welcoming arms of a South Africa. If it goes south, which it's certainly happening at the moment, the people have got absolutely nowhere to go. There are organizations currently happening. I'm not a part of them. I just know about them. And the numbers that they're talking about is 800,000. They are trying to raise funds for non-combatant, understand? The people are non-combatant because there's no way they are going to be able to fend off any military, which they're actually signing up. They've been called to sign up so that they can wipe the white man out. So there's organizations going around trying to raise money to buy food, generators, power, medical supplies, et cetera, et cetera. They have plans of action of where to meet and how to get out of the mainstream. And they're talking about 800,000 people that might make it. The rest, they will be annihilated.
And the rest, the numbers of the rest?
The rest of the white people, the farmers, they call
it. Give us a sense of the scale of it, Ronnie.
There's 4.6. Approximately 4.6 million white people, maybe five, and you're looking at 50 million people of other colors. And so when I say annihilated, I mean they will be assassinated. They will be absolutely mass genocide. Yes.
Ronnie Krauss, this is appallingly awful. I want to also mention, by the way, that colleague of ours, Katie Hopkins from the United Kingdom, has recently been in South Africa doing some quite courageous reporting on the situation there.
I have seen the YouTube video, yeah.
I commend it to our audience. Ronnie, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but I'm glad you're here safely in the United States, at least for the time being. And,
thank you.
Appreciate
you
this
guys
support.
Live in the land of milk and honey.
Well, I hope that we can keep it that way and provide some safe haven for people like yourself who are in great peril there in South Africa. Please come back to us with updates if you would. In the meantime, stay well.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by Ken Timmerman, investigative reporter par excellence, author of numerous important books, including Shadow Warriors, Traitors, Saboteurs, and the Party of Surrender. He has been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for work that he has done in connection with the Foundation for Democracy in Iran, which he founded and presides over. He's always a welcome guest here. Thank you so much for joining us, Ken Timmerman. Welcome back.
Frank, thanks for having me on, Frank. It's always a pleasure.
Well, we're confronting increasingly, Ken, as you know better than just about anybody, a metastasizing threat from Iran. It is manifesting itself particularly in connection with Israel, now not only from Lebanon, largely controlled by its proxies, Hezbollah, but also from Syria, where its own forces, as well as those of Hezbollah, are now operating with impunity. Give us, if you would, Ken, sort of a 30,000-foot level assessment of how serious this problem is, both for Israel and for our interests in the region and perhaps even our own security here.
Well, I guess, Frank, at 30,000 feet, that might be the altitude at which those Iranian missiles can become perceptible to the Israeli eye as they're arriving from various parts of Iran. But look, Iran over the past couple of years during the Syrian civil war has really taken it upon itself to expand dramatically its presence onto the borders with Israel. They have opened a land bridge through Iraq. That was their main goal in joining up with the Iraqi government to fight back ISIS, was to allow them to move forces through Iraq into Syria and from Syria into Lebanon and Israel's borders. They are now there. And we know just a couple of months ago, and I'm sure that our listeners are aware of this, the Iranians sent their militia leaders and Hezbollah leaders right up to the Israeli border, basically to thumb their noses at Israel. So they now have demonstrated this capability. They want to squeeze Israel from the north, from the Syrian side, and from Gaza at the same time. This is, I think, what is certainly Israeli leaders are fearing today, a three-pronged assault, military assault on Israel.
Yeah, and increasingly manifesting, again, itself as missile threats to Israel, missiles and rockets capable of reaching the entirety of the country, some of them with increasing precision. Ken Timmerman, it's almost unimaginable what a threat that might represent, even in the absence of nuclear weapons. And I wanted to tie into this point that you made in a recent piece at Front Page Magazine about a Major General Mohsen Rezai, who founded Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Tell us what he has been saying of late and why we should be very concerned about it.
Well, Rezai remains one of the top five leaders in Iran today, and he has a very dedicated coterie of officers from the IRGC who support him. He's been a presidential candidate on and off, but he's also the father of Iran's long-range ballistic missile programs and was the first head of their nuclear weapons program. And I tell this story at Front Page Mag that I learned from his son, who learned English in my basement after he defected to the United States. Rezai went to North Korea in 1993 to cement a deal with the grandfather of Little Rocket Man, right? And he sat down with him a year before he died, and essentially got a North Korean buy-in to help Iran build nuclear weapons. At the time, the Iranians had just acquired three nuclear artillery shells from the black market in pieces from Kazakhstan, I believe. But they were missing something. And he told his son on the way back from North Korea, and this is the story that I tell, he told his son, we just got those pledge from North Korea to get those missing pieces. So now Iran is an independent state, meaning we have nuclear weapons should anybody attack us. And the other piece of that story that's important, Frank, is that he was at the time working with North Korea on a new missile. At the time, it was called the Zelzal-3, later known as the Shahab-3, that moderate missile, as Bill Clinton had called it, because it could only reach the state of Israel. It was designed with a CEP, a circle error probable of between 1,000 and 6,000 meters. You know exactly what that means. It was so wildly inaccurate that the only use it had was to deliver a nuclear warhead against a city.
Yeah. This makes particularly troubling the pronouncement of this Major General Rezai recently that Iran would, quote, level Tel Aviv to the ground. Tel Aviv, of course, being the largest city in Israel. You take this as a very serious threat, do you not, Ken Timmerman?
I do. And that's why I wanted to relate that story about Rezai going to North Korea. He knows what he's speaking about, and he does not make those threats idly. He knows exactly what he's saying, and he knows that Iran has a nuclear weapons capability.
Ken, you have been very involved over the years with those who are seeking justice from Iran for having attacked and murdered American citizens. And there was a development recently that was quite striking. The Trump administration has, of course, departed from the practices of certainly the Obama administration and arguably the Bush administration as well in a number of regards when it comes to Iran and this so-called Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA. But would you talk about this lawsuit there's been an important development in involving the family of Shlomo Lubavitch?
Right. Well, so the lawyers in this case decided, because they have a judgment against Iran, to go after Boeing. Why Boeing? Because Boeing just got the approval to sell, under Obama, to sell $16 billion worth of civilian airliners to Iran as part of the loosening of sanctions under the Iran nuclear deal.
Airliners, which would almost certainly be used by the Iranian military, would they not?
Absolutely. As the recipients, both Iran Air and especially Mahan Air, have been using Boeing airliners to bring troops back and forth to Syria and weapons back and forth to Syria. You bet. And so they went to Boeing and said, look, we want to see your contract. Boeing said, no way. They went to court. They actually won in court. And the judge asked the Justice Department, do you have any opinion in this case? And Boeing was, of course, expecting that Jeff Sessions would do exactly like the Obama Justice Department did before and intervene and quash the whole thing. Instead, Jeff Sessions says no, and I have consulted with the White House, and we think these plaintiffs should be able to go right ahead, get access to your contracts, which means this. It's a lot of legalese here, Frank, but here's the bottom line, is that Iran pays money up front to Boeing, so Boeing will produce the aircraft. That money has to be someplace. And this lawsuit allows the plaintiffs to go after that money and essentially put the kibosh on the Boeing deal without the Trump administration having to say anything.
Yeah,
in public.
A twofer. I think we might
twofer.
Call it.
A twofer. It's absolutely
Hey,
absolutely
Ken, very
brilliant.
Quickly, you mentioned the long-running involvement of North Korea in Iran and its weapons programs, missiles as well as nuclear technologies. Very quickly, Ken Timmerman, a student of both the bad actors on the planet and these two in particular, your advice for Donald Trump as he prepares for a summit with the fellow you rightly say he calls Little Rocket Man?
Right. Well, the first thing is to sever, if at all possible, Iran from North Korea. Their programs, both nuclear and missile, are joint programs. Everything North Korea has got, Iran has got access to. The Iranians are financing the North Korean regime with about $2 billion to $2.5 billion a year. If President Trump can put a wedge between those two countries, it would be tremendous for world peace.
Yeah. Ken Timmerman, thank you for the great work that you do. I am appreciative of your visiting with us from time to time, and we'll talk with you again very soon. Bill Gertz joins us next, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's time for, well, one of the high points of my week for sure, and I think for yours. That is our visit with Bill Gertz of the Washington Free Beacon and Washington Times, who gives us his insights as one of the country's preeminent national security reporters about what's going on inside the building, as they say, the Pentagon, the Inside the Ring column. His prize-winning feature at the Washington Times is a great resource for all of us, as are his seven superb books, including his most recent one, iWar, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill Gertz, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Hi, Frank. Always good to be on the show.
Well, you had a piece in the Inside the Ring column that couldn't be more fortuitously timed, and that is a discussion of the military planning that the Pentagon seems to be engaged in at the moment with respect to North Korea, clearly part of the pressure campaign that has seemingly contributed to this so-called breakthrough. Bill, I'd like to get your thoughts, first of all, on the breakthrough itself and what role, in fact, the Pentagon is playing in facilitating a concentrating of the mind, shall we say, of the North Korean regime.
Yeah, this is the military component of the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration has been engaged in since last year. And obviously, they have really slammed North Korea with sanctions. I was told they really went to the mat with the Chinese last year, that the Chinese were going to try and block a UN sanctions resolution, and the Chinese backed down on that. China still continuing to covertly supply North Korea, but the Pentagon is doing its part, which is looking at the logistics, planning, real planning. And I'm told that when they had been doing this kind of updated planning, it was done on an irregular basis. Now they're doing it on a regular basis. They're checking everything to make sure that if the president were to decide to go the military route, that that U.S. military forces through the Pacific Command and then U.S. Forces Korea would be ready to do that if so called upon.
And is it fair to say, Bill, that these preparations were evident to the North Koreans as well?
Well, I think that they're certainly aware of it. I think the North Korean calculation has been that the sanctions, they're looking at real sanctions this time, not symbolic sanctions, not half-hearted sanctions. They're looking at being squeezed. And we had some testimony this week from the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, and he was asked about are the sanctions beginning to bite, and he said yes. Clearly there are indications that the North Koreans are definitely going to be feeling the pain of these new sanctions. So that's probably, and again, Trump has taken credit for driving Kim Jong-un to the negotiating table. Now, that said, this could be very much like the Peanuts character, Lucy and Charlie Brown, getting, you know, the U.S. really wants to kick the football, but the North Koreans are ready to pull it away at the last minute. So we'll have to wait and see how it plays out.
Yeah, fascinating focus of effort for us in the weeks ahead, for sure, Bill Gertz, and we look forward to discussing it with you. You mentioned China having acceded to some of that pressure. We have also had, however, warnings, particularly by the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, that China, as well as Russia, is engaged in what has been described as a low-level conflict against the United States. Bill, I think that must come as a shock to most Americans. I'm sure not our audience, but talk a little bit about how that is manifesting itself.
Yeah, Army Lieutenant General Robert Ashley, the DIA director, was before the Senate Armed Services Committee this week. And unlike the Intel Committee hearing, he did not have a separate testimony, but his separate testimony was much more blunt than the overall assessment presented by DNI Coates. And he talked about, he was asked about what the Chinese and the Russians are doing. He says, well, if you ask someone in the back rooms of Zhang Nanhai or the Kremlin, they'll say basically, yeah, they're engaged in low-level warfare against the United States. This, to me, is a major breakthrough. I've been hammering this issue, especially through my book, I War, that, you know, we are at war. This is an information age, and our adversaries are using information operations to attack us, to defeat us. And it's only now that we're beginning to see that.
Yeah. I spoke about this with several of our colleagues, Bill, at CPAC 2 weeks ago, and made this point that, as you've talked about frequently on this program, the whole unrestricted warfare agenda is playing out, information warfare being among the instruments, including the Confucius Institutes, which I'm pleased to say it seems to be getting a considerably greater attention, not only on Capitol Hill and in the press, but by the FBI. You must take heart from that.
Yes, that's very good. In fact, in the Free Beacon this week, we had a partially of a CIA intelligence report really warning about the Confucius Institute's role in subversion, especially on campuses. There's over 100 of these institutes. They're all government funded. They ostensibly are there to teach Chinese language and culture, but their real purpose is to provide China with cover for its subversion efforts against the United States. And again, it's good. It's a good sign that both the FBI and our other intelligence agencies are becoming alert to this.
You've written, in addition to the piece that we just discussed about the DIA testimony, three things that are sort of interrelated, that the U.S. is tailoring its nuclear forces to deter China's nuclear threat, point one. Point two, that we're looking at an intensification of our efforts to deal with their capabilities and those of the Russians to engage in space warfare. And finally, that there is a bill that is now awaiting the president's signature that would involve ramping up relations with Taiwan, something that, of course, the Chinese vehemently oppose. Tell us about these aspects of the China relationship at the moment.
Yes, this was a piece that I did for the Free Beacon on testimony before the House Armed Services Strategic Forces Subcommittee, in which, first of all, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, John Rood, he's the key central defense policymaker, outlined a new space warfare doctrine. And it's based on the national security strategy that says, look, our satellites are vital, not just to our military, but to our way of life. And that any attack on these satellites will be met with a massive response. Didn't outline what the response was, didn't say whether we're building weapons, but this is really a very significant step forward in defending our satellite systems, which are, again, one of our most important strategic assets and, again, central to everything we do, from banking to watching television. And we know that our enemies are developing robust anti-satellite capabilities, and that makes you wonder what the U.S. is doing, and so far they haven't really outlined it. As far as the Taiwan issue, this is definitely, Congress has passed a law, sense of the Congress, which is now awaiting signature by the president. I'm told that he's going to sign it in the next few days, which would increase military and civilian exchanges with Taiwan. And this is a very important step because the Taiwanese have been pressured viciously by mainland China, communist China, and now the U.S. is recognizing the need to definitely step up relations. This will allow for higher level visits, especially among the military. And again, under the Taiwan Relations Act of 1979, we're essentially obligated to defend Taiwan if the mainland attacks.
Hugely important. Bill, thanks so much for your time today. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.